Hello, I'm Sheila Dillon, and welcome to this BBC download of the Food Programme. For information on the BBC's terms and conditions of use, visit www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Even though I'm new media, I still love books.
The power of the individual has already changed the landscape.
Adrift in the sea of change.
The last 2 years have been more exciting than any other time I can think of.
There's no screen. You project onto surfaces.
It's got a slightly anarchic feel to it. Feels a bit like the Wild West.
Does the cookbook have a future? Most of us have at least a small collection of them, grease-spattered, annotated, and loved. But for increasing numbers of people, cookbooks are not where they get their cooking advice. What they want, they download from the great digital chaos of cyberspace. Is that the future or a passing phase? Or will it all get a lot more sci-fi? Is the printed book an endangered species? To discuss these questions, I'm joined by Neil Denny, editor-in-chief of the trade magazine The Bookseller, Chef Ben Ebrell, co-founder of SortedFood.com, a cooking website based around a group of friends that's been a runaway success, and pop-up restaurant pioneer Ms. Marmite Lover, also known as Kirsten Rogers, blogger and author of Supper Club, Recipes and Notes from the Underground Restaurant. Ben, what's the most important recent development in the world of cookbooks, would you say?
I think it's the availability. So you can walk into any high street shop, you can browse online and see what books you want to find before you go and head to that shop. They just seem to be available everywhere in such an array, a huge, vast selection of cookbooks.
Neil?
I would completely agree with that, actually. And I would say, in fact, it's the sale in supermarkets of cookbooks that's been the single biggest factor in making cookbooks a much bigger category in publishing terms in the last 10 years.
People pick them up as part of their everyday cycle of shopping in the supermarket rather than going specifically to a bookstore.
And I think allied to that, clearly, is the rise of the kind of TV chef and the increased number of cooking programmes on television. They've been feeding off each other. It certainly has created winners at the top that are bigger than ever before. So Jamie Oliver is the biggest selling author in Britain last year.
In any category?
In any category. Now, that's pretty surprising when you think about it, in a way. But then his books cost quite a lot of money. He's on TV a lot. He was backed by Sainsbury's. You know, all those kind of allied reasons.
Kirsten, I mean, what would you say then is the biggest development in cookbooks?
Obviously the online phenomenon. So there's TV feeding cookbooks. I think more and more in the future it will be blogging, vlogging, which is video blogging, and the iPad, the Kindle, different ways of reading.
The tablets. Andrew Webb is a man who straddles the old and new media. He edits the lovefood.com website and wrote Food Britannia, which recently won the Guild of Food Writers Book of the Year Award. The perfect man to help us discover what the digital storm will do to food books.
As a food journalist who works on the web, as well as a published author, I'm interested in the future of cookery books. Is it on phones? Is it on the web? Is it even on something we can't imagine yet? Or is the future still squarely with the book? I'm off to meet Mary-Claire Jerram, publishing director for Dorling Kindersley, one of the biggest players in cookbook publishing. Mary-Claire, you've brought me here two things. We've got one of your flagship books, £25 hardback, full colour, and then here we've got exactly the same content in an iPad app at £3.99. How much is the digital strategy part of the company's focus?
I'd say at the senior management level, it's a huge focus at the moment because the technology is changing so fast. Now, a month ago, we planned what we'd launch between now and Christmas, and we've already had a meeting since then to change it. So in terms of the number of people working on digital product, it's still pretty small, but in terms of the amount of headspace, it's pretty big. We hope that and believe that consumers will always want good quality information. In the terms of a cookbook, that means recipes that work. But we also feel that we can add extra to just the recipes. So we can have superb step-by-step photography. We can have this ability to shoot off shopping lists. It's constantly thinking of ways that will add to the cook's experience and make it better than what's free on the internet.
So if I get this right, the key to your survival from a revenue point of view is authoritative, curated information.
Yes. When you bump into ex-colleagues at the big book fairs, everyone says, what are you doing about digital? We're all trying to find out what each other's doing. And really, we're all doing roughly the same, which is we're in there, we're dying to create more product, but we're not throwing huge sums of money at the moment. It's nervous, but it's also very, very exciting. I've been in publishing for 30 years now, and the last 2 years have been more exciting than any other time I can think of.
Wow. So it seems the strategy for apps and e-books is evolving at an incredibly fast pace. It's got a slightly anarchic feel to it. Feels a bit like the Wild West. No one's quite sure where it's going to go and who's going to win and who's going to lose.
Andrew Webb. We'll rejoin him in a few minutes. But first, Neil, as the book trade insider, can you give us a picture of the publishing world right now?
Well, the general situation is sales of printed books are down. In terms of the overall print market, it's down 8 or 9% on the year, but we think that that's being offset by digital. Digital is currently not captured in any valid way statistically, so we have to make a guess about that.
You mean you don't count downloads of books?
No, the downloads aren't registered because the people that have the information won't share it across the industry, whereas in print they do. In terms of digital crossover, we're reckoning that within 2 to 3 years it'll be 30 to 40% and possibly parity 50-50 within sort of 5 or 6 years. In the specific area of cookery books, it's actually a very solid category in print even now. So the value of cookery books sold in the UK in 2001 was 55 million. By 2011, then it got up to 87 million. It's steady progression upwards. The digital inroads into cookery is quite low because most of the digital crossover is happening on Kindle, and that is black and white, and cookery books don't really work on Kindle. It's as straightforward as that, basically. Now, that may well change in the future, but that's the position right now. Like all publishing, 9 books fail and 1 book succeeds. I mean, that basic rule still applies. But because it's a hardback market principally and a gift market at Christmas, it is very lucrative for publishers, yes.
There seems so many cookbooks remaindered, you know, the glossy recipe books that have come out, £25, £30.
Yeah, there's inherent waste in the system in that you don't know if a book's going to succeed until you publish it, largely. Now, that may change with e-books, which provide more confidence to publishers. So if something works online, you know there's an established market for it. And in a parallel market of fiction right now, the biggest book, which is 50 Shades of Grey, was originally an e-book. And it was that success that allowed them to invest heavily in print. And it's become a very big book as a result of that.
So the whole book publishing is dominated by S&M Erotica and Jamie Oliver.
Those are the big commercial hits. In the end, people buy the books they want to buy.
Ben, you're riding a new type of food wave in which books play a key role, but they're not exactly the main event.
No, originally it started with books. It was a group of friends of us all sat around a table sharing recipes, literally the 8 of us on beer mats. And we'd dish them out, try this, try that. And we decided we would self-publish a cookbook to share these recipes with just a few more people. We got it off the ground a lot quicker than the publishing world could have done. We weren't restricted by the way the publishing world works. So 6 months from idea to book, completely against the system. And now we focus an awful lot online, so publishing daily video recipes.
For the details, click on the link below and it'll take you to the website where all the details are written out for you.
It's balanced, it's got some wacky flavours that really do work. It's our mango and strawberry salad.
I urge you to try this right now. This really works. And upload the pictures to Facebook. So colourful.
But that's supplemented with the book, which will always remain a gift market.
So you have a new book coming out. How did that happen?
Because of the website, because of the traction we had online and the existing audience, but also the self-published books had already proved a concept. So this risk of producing a book, as Neil was saying, this one had already proved a concept.
So you get, what is it, 1 million hits a month?
Just shy of 1 million video views a month at the moment.
So why do you need a book?
It's not necessarily there to make money, although there will be revenues from it, but it's more about building up in an audience. What we try and do online is build a community of people who want to cook, and offline you will always reach more people with a book because you're catching them in the supermarket when they're least expecting it, or in a bookstore, or bought as a gift from somebody who is giving it to someone who might not already be considering food. So it's bringing in new eyeballs to something that we do and we love doing online.
Now let's go back to Andrew Webb.
So I'm off to get another perspective now. Hardeep Singh Kohli is an author, broadcaster and raconteur.
The one thing we've seen in the last 5 or 10 years is the power of the food blogger, actually. I think the respect paid to food writers that aren't being paid to do it for a living is really upsetting the apple cart in terms of those of us who've been trying to make a living out of food writing. So I think the power of the individual in the world of food writing has already changed the landscape, and I think increasingly there is going to be a more intimate relationship between those that are interested in reading about food and those that write about food. So I think the way that's monetized, I think brands are going to be looking for particular bloggers to place their ads around, because food is so important and is such a passion that if you find someone that talks to you, like I will watch Nigel Slater read The Phone Book. Yota Motulenge can talk to me about the football results in Abu Dhabi and I will listen because I can hear the food in his voice. We have to ask ourselves why people read, and people read for the pleasure and the escape of reading.
Publishers always talk about the three B's: bus, bath and bed, and that's where people mainly read books.
Yes.
And it's, you know, on the bus, in the bath and in bed. And the argument used to be that, you know, a desktop PC doesn't fit in any of those scenarios. But do you see that sort of level of intimacy that books have with ebooks and digital books and tablets and those sorts of things? Will a soul be there?
I would rather people were reading than not reading.
Mm.
I would rather be part of a civilization that encouraged people to engage with the written word. And I think there is more than a slight element of the Luddite and the snob in deciding how people do that. I don't think the existence of tablets and Kindles and the like is actually going to stop people owning books, because you can't turn down the corner of a Kindle.
Yeah.
You know, you can't inscribe a Kindle. I'm never going to give you, much as I like you, Andy, I'm never going to give you a Kindle for your birthday.
Oh.
So that's the difference.
Hardeep Singh Kohli. Kristen, you've now got your book out. How does that fit in with everything else you do?
Well, first of all, I started my food blog, and I didn't think anybody was reading it, really. I just was writing my thoughts about food, my recipes. It was kind of like a notebook, really. So it's very personal. And I think I had 10 readers a day. I was quite thrilled when I had 10 readers a day. And then I started my supper club, The Underground Restaurant. I said, well, I'm starting this restaurant in my living room. And suddenly all these people kind of crawled out the digital woodwork. Suddenly my blog was on the map. It was very exciting. I knew as soon as I started the supper club, there was a book in it. So I got an agent, which you don't necessarily have to do, but it makes it easier. And we put out the concept and HarperCollins went for it. The great thing about a blog is a publisher can see how you write, can see your approach. Again, it's like a proof of concept.
But if there's no money in it, why was a book important to you then?
I love books. I could spend my life in bookshops. So even though I'm new media primarily, I still love books. And it's a valuable, covetable thing to possess. It's beautiful.
Let's rejoin Andrew Webb.
So these are unpredictable times for the publishing industry, as well as big-name talent. Is it harder than ever to break into cookery book writing? I'm off to meet Anthony Topping, literary agent for the likes of Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, Thomasina Myers, as well as Little Old Me.
The role of an agent is to manage the career of the writers that he or she represents. Sometimes we may help a writer improve what they're doing, but certainly what we're always doing is selling the products to a publishing house or a TV company. In terms of how we have found our clients in the past, I think that's been somewhat a passive role. People would be writing to us and we'd be considering those submissions, or our existing clients would be recommending us to their writer friends. But we're at an interesting junction now, because that was maybe the non-connected world. But in this connected world, and we're talking particularly about food writers and writing, people who are doing exciting things in the world of food, they're shouting about it, and they're shouting about it online through their blogs or through Twitter. And these days, it doesn't take very long at all for somebody to start doing something very exciting that suddenly becomes extremely visible online. And people are also online and excited about food, are eager to share their likes with their online friends. So we're now in a world where an agent has little excuse for not knowing what's going on in the world of food and food writing, because if it's exciting, you can see it. And frankly, the printed book is still incredibly important. One of the first things we consider is which of the major professional publishing houses we can talk to. They're still thinking about a printed book. Some of the bigger, better adapted companies are thinking about what apps they might do at the same time as the printed book. But in many respects, those apps are promotional tools. Sometimes they may charge for them, sometimes they may not. But the rump of their business is the printed book. Publishers have and always will have the categories in which they'd like to publish. They always have an idea of what they have on the list and what they haven't yet got on the list. There's always a few slots and they're waiting for the perfect person to come along. And very often you have somebody who's doing something exciting in the real world who has got no conception at all about what a publisher might be looking for. And that's where an agent can make the difference, because an agent will know the publisher, will know what they're looking out for. And if I come across somebody that fills that slot, I'm in there because I know exactly who I'm going to talk to about it. The successful books have always been successful because of word of mouth, but I think actually the online medium is reinforcing that and making it a stronger and stronger part of how people are finding books that they might like to read.
Everyone, it seems, from the old tradition are playing catch-up, you know, agents and publishers. What about booksellers, Neil?
Well, they are equally, you know, adrift, if you like, in this sea of change. On the one hand, you have Amazon, who have kind of grown up with digital, clearly, and they're doing a very solid job and they're growing in the market. At the other extreme, you have the small independent bookshops who are suffering. In the middle, you have the chains and the supermarkets. Supermarkets are pretty solid. The chains have had a difficult period. Borders has obviously vanished. Waterstones is in a period of transition under new ownership and trying some interesting new things, actually, one of which is the Amazon e-reader will be available in Waterstones and you can have a coffee and download a book on the Wi-Fi in the branch or go home and go online. That's a different kind of offer almost, yet to see whether it will work. I mean, this comes in this autumn, so, you know, the jury's out on it at the moment.
Back to Andrew Webb, who's now on the history trail.
I'm really excited now because I'm headed to the Guildhall Library. There's a unique collection of cookbooks spanning hundreds of years. I'm hoping not only to get some insights into where cookbook publishing has come from, but also, as a book geek, I'm looking forward to getting my hands on some first editions.
So I'm here in the Guildhall Library with Dr. Peter Ross, who's the principal librarian of the Guildhall's collection of food books. We're now going down a few levels to the third floor below ground.
So this is where we keep our wine and food books. So we have 10,000 books on wine and food, the largest collection in any public library. In England, the real history of cookery books starts in the late 16th century. This is Sir Hugh Platt's Delights for Ladies. It sort of demonstrates that books on cookery were published by basically the nobility, the upper, what we would now call middle classes.
Right.
And they were published in connection with distilling and conserving and in husbandry and housewifery, mm-hmm. And not as individual cookery books necessarily. So then the next stage of cookery books are those that appear in the middle of the 17th century that emanate from professional cooks who are working either for the royal household or for aristocracy and nobility. The next ones are into the early 18th century, where you start to get people who were professional cooks, again in big households, but are producing cookery books of their own, which are cookery books as we've recognised them today, which contain recipes.
So we've got in here vermicelli pudding and raffetta pudding, bread and butter pudding, a ragu of veal, and then some slightly more esoteric things like calf's head boiled. The range is immense.
Towards the end of the 18th century is where we get food writers who are professional cooks working not for noble households, but working in London usually, working in the big pubs and inns. So, that, for instance, this one is by John Farley.
And the London Tavern.
This was at the London Tavern, that's right.
Yeah.
So this was published by him sort of to show off. London Tavern was the famous place to dine in London in the late 18th, early 19th century. This is the beginning of celebrity chefs. So in Hannah Glass's The Art of Cookery, which is 1747, she specifically decides to make her recipes understandable to the ordinary person and not to a professional cook. So Hannah Glass's attitude to food is a real turning point in the history of cooking.
And then, of course, we come to this enormous, great imperial purple tome.
So this is Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, which was published in the 1850s originally. This is actually a later edition. This is one of Elizabeth David's own copies. She lists the ingredients first. So she breaks down the recipe as we would recognise it today. So ingredients first, then she has the method. She tells you how long it's going to take to cook, how many it will serve, and what the cost of the dish is. Mm. And that's the sort of thing you get in recipe books today. So this is where it sort of starts. Other people have done it before, Mrs. Beaton, but she popularises that form of laying a recipe out. I think what will happen, and what I've started to do at home, is I use my son's iPad when I'm cooking, and if I've downloaded a recipe, because you can wipe clean your iPad. You might have a few problems turning the pages when you've got flour or water on your hands, but on the whole, you can flick backwards and forwards on an iPad.
I love the fact that you've got here probably the greatest collection of cookbooks in London and that you're using an iPad at home. I think that's brilliant. What an amazing experience, and so interesting and varied. It was a privilege to get my hands on some of those books.
So, you know, we've learned from Anthony Topping and Peter Ross how cookbooks have changed and are still changing. Who writes them now, and who are they written for?
I think when it comes to food, everybody needs food, but everybody uses food in different ways. It's either functional, in which case it's every one of us every day cooking midweek meals, and therefore there's a very large audience of people who want that kind of simple, fuss-free cooking, and that's kind of what we do. And then there's the other end, which is people who love and want to cherish every element of that dish and use it as leisure and as a hobby. And then there's a whole other market there, not to mention the science and the gastronomy at another end, which is more of a fascination, almost geeky approach to food. So there's lots of different markets within food itself.
I mean, at the moment, it seems the best, most successful ones are the TV chefs. And the people that buy them, I guess they're buying them for presents. It's mostly probably women that buy them.
Do you think that's true? That women buy most cookbooks?
The beauty of being online is everything is so transparent. So we can see exactly who are engaging with us and watching our videos online. And then we assume the same for cookbooks. And we have a larger percentage of female audience. But
you're guys.
But there is, and we, as guys.
So you're going for that Jamie Oliver audience, which has made young men think cooking's cool. Yeah. In fact, perhaps you were influenced by Jamie Oliver.
Indeed. It was one of my first cookbooks, and I had his cookbook bought for me every Christmas as a gift, because that's what cookbooks remain.
Well, that's it. You see, that's a good point, though, isn't it? Gifting is a big part of this market. So men buy women cookbooks and vice versa. You know, that can happen. But I think the actual usage is probably female-dominated even now.
Is there an analogy here with the music industry? You know, digital downloads are affecting album sales, but there are always these people who want the hard copy. Are new models arising that keep revenue for book publishers and booksellers while providing these opportunities for authors and these technological innovations, Kirsten?
Well, I suppose, I mean, my blog, for instance, which is a form of publishing, I don't make any money from the blog. I make money from the dinners that I do. So it's a bit like if you're a music artist, you don't make money from albums anymore. You make money from your gigs, from live touring. So you can't replace that experience.
Ben?
Well, I think also in smaller portions. So we do daily video recipes that are 3-4 minutes long, and its function is, what am I going to cook today? Rather than a whole book of 100-odd recipes that will last me ages, I want to know about today and maybe tomorrow. It's very now. And the way that you look at things like iTunes, and I don't want to buy a whole album, I just want to buy a couple of tracks.
Yeah.
Will cook and recipes move into that micro payment? I just want 3 recipes to download, and I'm going to pay 14-15p for each of them. Maybe that is the future of cooking.
I think that will definitely happen, and I think you'll see packaging where you can construct your own cookbook. So you buy individual chapters online and create the book and have it printed, or just access it online. That will start happening in food writing,
definitely. We're seeing it already on our site. People can access, there's 250 odd recipes there, but if you log in through Facebook, they're all free, and you can create your own cookbook from your favourites. And we are seeing users do that and generate their favourites they come back to time and time again. So it is already happening.
It is mind-boggling. Let's join Andrew now for the last leg of his journey.
We're now in London's fashionable Silicon Roundabout near Old Street, and I'm here to meet Ian Malone, who's MD of an apps development company. We are apps.com, have begun to specialise in production specifically of food apps, and who better to tell me where the future's heading?
Ian, can you tell me where the app industry is at the moment?
Right at the very beginning. I think virginal would be the best way to describe it. Certainly in the food space, which is where increasingly we're working, yes, there have been some enormously successful operators like Jamie Oliver and Nigella. But for most people putting out cooking apps at the moment, it's a pretty new thing. The whole industry can't be much more than 2 years old, really, so it's got a long way to go. And I think it's possibly one of the most exciting things that I've seen as a digital person for the past 15 or so years, which is exactly why we started the company a couple of years ago. what we're busy doing at the moment is establishing a product that helps the non-publishers produce cooking apps. So really our target market is going to be the food bloggers, the food writers, for want of a better expression, the minor celebrity chefs or right. second tier celebrity chefs. And of course, you know, the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands worldwide, cooks who have restaurants or bistros who have got great recipes inside their head and either just, you know, want to monetize their content that they own or, you know, want to promote what they're doing for their restaurants. The coolest thing that I've seen for a very long time, and it's very much still a prototype, is something that hangs around people's necks. And there's no screen. You project onto surfaces. And so when they wanted to have a phone, they put their palm of their hand in front of the projector and a little telephone dial came up on it. So, I mean, that's the way that things are going. They reckon that's around about 5 or 6 years away from active production. And then obviously it needs to get taken up by the general population.
What a day. I've seen everything from cutting-edge app design to 500-year-old first-edition cookbooks. I've got a real sense of the breadth and scale of cookery writing and the innovations that have happened. Cookbooks have evolved. They always will. But what hasn't changed is the communication of a great idea, of a story, of good photography, design. These things transcend all mediums. At the moment, it's apps and ebooks, and who knows what it'll be in the future. What I do know is there's never been a more exciting time to be a food writer.
Andrew Webb. So where are we heading? Neil, Kirsten, Ben, peer into the future for us. I mean, where will the cookbook be in 5 years, 10, 50?
Cookbooks, it's definitely going to be quite science fiction. In fact, I have got an iPad now. I want magnetic tape on the back so I can put it on my fridge and play a video to remind me of the recipe while I'm cooking. Hands-free. A cookbook isn't hands-free.
And yet you'd rather put high-tech equipment into a dirty, dusty, wet, smoky, steamy kitchen than a paperback. I think that's the way it's going to go. I completely agree with you.
If you've got something that you could project in the air and swipe it somehow with your movement, something virtual, that would be fantastic. I'm all for that. That sounds great.
I have no idea what tablet form process we'll be absorbing it, but it will be micro installments of just the recipes and information we need at that point, not overwhelmed with a world of other things in between many, many pages.
I think maybe in the kitchen it will be done mainly on screen by the serious chefs, but I do think the amateurs, the everyday people, will still have a tatty paperback or a spine-broken hardback when they want to cook for a dinner party or a friend in the kitchen for many, many years to come.
Nothing more satisfying than the sound of the thud of a cookbook when you put it down at the end of the day and you can't throw your tablet onto the work surface.
Thank you all very much. Neil Denny, Kirsten Rogers and Ben Ebrell.